We are now going to proceed with a very, very important article from the current issue of Covert Action Information Bulletin. Specifically, this article is from Covert Action Information Bulletin, issue number 35. That is the issue from the fall of 1990. Covert Action, as I said earlier in the broadcast, is a quarterly. And this particular issue is one of the most important, in my opinion. Once again, I will give the address for Covert Action Information Bulletin. Covert Action Information Bulletin, P.O. Box 34583. That's in Washington, D.C., 20043. That is the address for CAIB, for those of you who might like to order this very, very important issue. In last week's first installment of this archive series, I read almost all of an article called Nurturing Baltic Reaction by Philip Banoski. And now I'm going to read all of an article called A Full Court Press, The Destabilization of the Soviet Union. This is by Sean Gervasi, G-E-R-V-A-S-I, and he is described here in the bio note as an American economist. He has written a very, very important article, and I think quite correctly, Mr. Gervasi has analyzed the Reagan military buildup and a hard line toward the Soviet Union as a tool, and apparently a very effective tool, of economic warfare in the apparently ongoing destabilization of the Soviet Union. This article reads as follows. I'm going to read the whole article. It speaks very eloquently for itself. Now, what we're going to be looking at this evening is the external pressure being brought to bear on the Soviet Union, and as I have explained, I think both the injection of fascist elements into the Baltics, or Lithuania in particular, as well as the U.S. military adventure into the Middle East on the Soviet southern flank, represents pressure being exerted against the Soviet Union, in essence, a flanking maneuver both on their southern and northern flank, and I think that that is intended to bring about further destabilization of the Soviet Union by promoting and necessitating a hard line and even further military crackdowns. This will be used to justify the Cold War. That will be used to further strain the already badly shaken Soviet economy by necessitating continued high levels of military spending. I will read now A Full Court Press, The Destabilization of the Soviet Union by Sean Gervasi. During the early months of the first Reagan administration, it became abundantly clear that the U.S. was embarking on a policy of confrontation with the Soviet Union. Political observers had begun talking about a new Cold War. By 1982, relations with the Soviet Union were becoming tense, as were relations with some NATO allies. In the U.S. and in Europe, the bellicosity of the Reagan administration gave rise to a growing fear of nuclear conflict. Yet if the U.S. seemed intent upon confrontation, even upon playing nuclear chicken, quote-unquote, with the Soviet Union, it was not at all clear what it expected to achieve by doing so. The Reagan administration's policies were clear, but the objectives of those policies were not. Many observers began to fear, especially in Europe, that some members of the new U.S. administration might actually want a nuclear war, believing that the United States might somehow prevail, quote-unquote. In fact, the Reagan administration was not driving towards nuclear war. Its extremely aggressive policies were not meant to lead to war, but to change and upheaval inside the Soviet Union. These policies were part of a strategy aimed at forcing the Soviet Union to retreat from the world stage and to adopt reforms which would carry it towards a regulated market economy, quote-unquote, that is, towards the dismantling of socialism. Continuing, a few analysts had seen what was happening. In 1982, Joseph Fromm made it clear that there was something, quote, behind the shift to a harder line in foreign policy, quote, unquote. By the way, that individual's name, Joseph Fromm, is spelled F-R-O-M-M. It might not be the correct pronunciation. Once again, repeating that last sentence, or last couple of sentences, a few analysts had seen what was happening. In 1982, Joseph Fromm made it clear that there was something, quote, behind the shift to a harder line in foreign policy, unquote. The U.S. was, in fact, waging limited economic warfare. The U.S. was, in fact, quote, waging limited economic warfare against Russia to force the Soviets to reform their political system, unquote. Fromm quoted an unnamed U.S. official as saying that, again quoting, the Soviet Union is in deep, deep economic and financial trouble. By squeezing wherever we can, our purpose is to induce the Soviets to reform their system. I think we will see results over the next several years, unquote. Unfortunately, such reports were few and far between at the time, and those that were published appeared to have been forgotten. Observers in the West and in the socialist bloc have, on the whole, seriously misunderstood the foreign and military policies pursued by the U.S. during the last decade. Thieves have been depicted as uneven and reckless because most analyses have focused on surface phenomena such as the expansion of military forces or efforts to deny the Soviet Union new technologies rather than on the strategy behind such policies. This strategy now needs to be examined and debated for two reasons. Firstly, it appears to have achieved a considerable measure of success. This is not generally recognized, particularly among critics of the Reagan administration from the center to the left. Conservatives, however, are openly arguing that the Reagan administration set in motion the policies which led to, quote, the defeat of communism, unquote. The editor of Policy Review, the flagship publication of the Heritage Foundation, wrote recently that the West had, quote, won, unquote, the Cold War because of the foreign policies pursued by conservative governments in every major country of the Western world. David Rubenstein, R-U-B-I-N-S-T-E-I-N, a sociologist at the University of Illinois, was more specific, quote, the key difference in Soviet policy between the 1970s and the 1980s, he wrote, again quoting, is to be explained not by further deterioration of the Soviet economy, but in changes in U.S. foreign policy, unquote. Interrupting, as we shall see, the changes in the Soviet economy and the changes in U.S. foreign policy appear to be directly related. That is, in many ways, the theme of what Sean Gervasi is talking about here. Secondly, continuing with his text, secondly, there is substantial evidence that having succeeded in aggravating the crisis in the Soviet Union, the U.S. and its allies are now engaged in building internal pressures there for further reforms. They are engaged in open, large-scale interference in the internal affairs of the Soviet Union. Conservative analysts are open about this. Rubenstein, for instance, expressed his concern that, quote, if the current sense of crisis is eased, the motivation for further reform may be lost, unquote. And he concluded that, again quoting, if internal pressure was a key factor in motivating this policy of reform, pressure may be required to keep it moving forward, unquote. Well, the key element of this section here, and this in many ways lays out the theme for the rest of Gervasi's article, is that pressure on the Soviet Union, both the military buildup under the Reagan years, designed to intimidate the Soviets into trying to match the U.S. military buildup with resulting disastrous effects on the Soviet economy and consequent destabilization and increased social strife inside the country, that this is being pursued by the Reagan and now Bush administrations and accompanied by direct interference in the internal affairs of the Soviet Union. And as we shall see in another article from CAIB that we'll go into next week, the Heritage Foundation and its founder, Paul Weyrich, are directly connected to some of this interference, and that pressure is believed to be needed here to keep the policy of reform proceeding forward. Reform, I think, should be taken in quotes. We saw last week about some of the, quote, reform, unquote, elements that are being projected into Lithuania, courtesy of LCRALIC and NED. If that's reform, I'd sure hate to see fascism. Continuing now with Sean Gervasi's article. One of the first public indications of the existence of a secret strategy to apply pressure against the Soviet Union came in March of 1981. Richard Pipes, P-I-P-E-S, a senior national security official in charge of Soviet affairs, gave a press interview which caused some controversy. Pipes, a Soviet expert on leave from Harvard University, told a Reuters correspondent that, quote, nothing was left of détente, unquote. Furthermore, he said, the new administration might soon pursue a foreign policy, quote, as radical as the new president's economic program, unquote. The Reagan administration, he told the interviewer, was moving towards a strategy of confrontation with the Soviet Union and with radical and socialist regimes in the Third World. The purpose of the strategy, Pipes indicated, was to change the world balance of forces in favor of the U.S. and its allies. The key sentence in the Pipes interview was, quote, Soviet leaders would have to choose between peacefully changing their communist system in the direction followed by the West and going to war. One more time. The key sentence in the Pipes interview was, quote, Soviet leaders would have to choose between peacefully changing their communist system in the direction followed by the West and going to war, unquote. And the New York Times describes Pipes as saying that, quote, there was no alternative to war with the Soviet Union if the Russians did not abandon communism, unquote. Repeating that sentence again. And the New York Times described Pipes as saying that, quote, there was no alternative to war with the Soviet Union if the Russians did not abandon communism, unquote. These words did not come from a middle-level government official. They came from the senior National Security Council officer in charge of Soviet affairs, and they were, for that reason, exactly seen as indicating a dangerous aggressiveness on the part of the Reagan administration. The Pipes interview rang alarm bells around the world. The White House immediately disavowed the interview, claiming that Pipes' remarks did, quote, not represent the views of the administration, unquote. Even so, U.S. allies protested vigorously. The Financial Times of London warned that the U.S. allies would be angered by any attempt to play what it called, quote, a dangerous game of chicken, unquote. Then the storm fell as suddenly as it had arisen, and nothing more was heard of the matter. In retrospect, it seems likely that Pipes was being used deliberately to alarm the Soviets so that they would try to match the U.S. military expansion then underway, particularly in the nuclear field. The Pipes leak, quote-unquote, is entirely consistent with a strategy of spending them into bankruptcy, again quoting and unquoting, or weakening Russia's economy, again quote-unquote. The last sentence is again. The Pipes leak is entirely consistent with a strategy of spending them into bankruptcy or weakening Russia's economy. The strategy itself, however, involved much more than the threat of nuclear war. A large number of studies by the Rand Corporation carried out in the early 1980s shed considerable light on the wider strategy and made it clear that the Reagan administration was not preparing for war, but mounting a sophisticated attack on the Soviet economy. The Rand Corporation is a California think tank which carries out a great deal of classified research, especially for the military. Its experts move in and out of government, and it is routinely asked to analyze and comment upon military and intelligence planning documents which are not accessible to an ordinary congressman. Rand, like a number of similar organizations, is in effect a part of the military intelligence complex. Many of the Rand studies in question were commissioned by the Department of Defense, and the published papers were often sanitized, quote-unquote, versions of classified studies. The titles of the papers themselves were suggestive. They included Economic Leverage on the Soviet Union, The Costs of the Soviet Empire, Sitting on Bayonets, question mark, The Soviet Defense Burden and Moscow's Economic Dilemma, unquote. Taken together, these papers were essentially concerned with two issues. The first was economic stringency, quote-unquote, in the Soviet Union, especially from the late 1970s. The second was what measures NATO countries could use to make that economic stringency more acute. These papers, moreover, developed a clear analytical line of argument which may be summarized as follows. Economic growth in the Soviet Union had begun to slow in the late 1970s, increasing the difficulties of meeting the various claims on its resources. At the same time, the Soviet Union was entering a leadership crisis, quote-unquote, as leadership of the Communist Party was being passed to a younger generation. The United States and its allies could take various actions which would force the Soviet Union to increase its defense spending and its economic and military assistance to allies and friends. They could also take measures to deny the Soviet Union access to credits, key imports, and modern technology, which is especially important for increasing productivity and accelerating growth. Such measures would either reduce the overall volume of resources available to the Soviet Union, hold back the growth of productivity, or force resources to be shifted from domestic consumption and investment. Each of these effects would aggravate the difficulties confronting the Soviet leadership in a stagnant economy. A combination of measures, quote, to impose costs, unquote, on the Soviet Union might be expected to lead to a fall in investment and/or living standards. A combination of such measures, consequently, might generate pressures within the Soviet Union for withdrawing from the world stage and for political and economic reforms. Thus, the Rand studies seem to be preparing the groundwork for a kind of hot-cold war aimed at weakening and possibly even breaking the back of the Soviet economy. In the 1980s, after a decade of détente, this was remarkable enough in itself. It is clear, however, that analysts believe the ultimate aim of this strategy should be to force change upon the Soviet Union. Thus, the Reagan, this quoting here from Abraham Becker, Economic Relations with the USSR, thus the Reagan administration sees Soviet economic troubles as an opportunity to complicate further their resource allocation dilemma in the hope that additional pressure would result in a reallocation of resources away from defense or would push the economy in the direction of economic and political reforms, unquote. Well, this article, and it's very well written, so far I think speaks quite clearly for itself, and I think his analysis is right on the money, and we will continue with the theme he has sounded here. We're going to finish the article, where we'll be carrying this line of discussion forward into what has just transpired in the Middle East and what I think is going to be transpiring in the Soviet Union and elsewhere in the not-too-distant future. To make a long story short, the Reagan military buildup was not intended to fight a nuclear war. It may, I'm afraid, wind up doing just that as a result of miscalculation. But it really was intended to destabilize the Soviet Union by straining the Soviet economy to the breaking point and thereby obliging the Soviets to abandon socialism. I think it's worth noting here in this regard that the discussion which I undertook in Radio Free America program number 3 and resumed again in Radio Free America number 30, dealing with the profound relationship between a woman named Helena von Damm and Ronald Reagan. Helena von Damm, to make a long story short, was Ronald Reagan's appointment secretary when he was governor of California. She drew up the lists of all of the people from which Ronald Reagan made his appointments when he was governor of California. She functioned in a similar capacity when Reagan became president of the United States. Helena von Damm had a relationship with Otto von Bolschwing, a key SS man, and for a time a member of the Galen organization that we've spoken about, and then later head of a parallel organization to Galen's in North America. According to one report, von Bolschwing was head of Galen's North American operation. Helena von Damm had a long-standing relationship with Otto von Bolschwing, which she now denies. She admitted to knowing him socially, was an investor in his company, and had translated some documents for Helena von Damm. The late Mae Brussel maintains that, in fact, when she was speaking with a reporter Pete Carey of the San Jose Mercury News, who eventually won a Pulitzer Prize for his work on the Marcos flight capital, that Helena von Damm was in fact the protege of Otto von Bolschwing. That has never appeared in print, but May said that that had been absolutely confirmed. I do not have that information in my immediate possession, but May wasn't wrong, and that I can recall, and her unnerving and frankly accurate forecasts have tragically come true. The relationship between Helena von Damm and Otto von Bolschwing should be borne in mind as we examine this policy of destabilization of the Soviet Union by forcing them to match our military buildup, thereby straining their economy to the breaking point. One of the things that I have spoken about over the years is the Nazi concept of Schrecklichkeit, or frightfulness. Basically, to make a long story short, although they were certainly not the first people by any means to use terror in a strategic way, the Nazis raised the use of terror to a science and formalized it in a way that had not been used before. They basically utilized what they called Schrecklichkeit, or frightfulness, to intimidate their opponents into doing what they wanted. And I think the destabilization policy, the expressed willingness to fight a nuclear war, represents a direct manifestation of Schrecklichkeit and is indicative not only of the Galen and German influence on our national security establishment, but in particular of the von Bolschwing, von Damm influence on the Reagan administration. Another of the important lessons to be learned from studying the real facts about the assassination of President Kennedy, as opposed to the fertilizer contained in the Warren Report, is that on the 22nd day of November in 1963, explicitly fascist and Nazi elements came into ascendance in this country. We went into Nazi connections to President Kennedy's assassination in the Guns of November Part 4 and came back to them in Radio Free America shows 11, 12, 13, and 15, as well as a miscellaneous archive show called Lee Harvey Oswald, Edwin Walker, and the Fourth Reich, all of those available from Archives on Audio. We see in Richard Pipe's statements that the Soviets must be prepared to give up communism or go to war a direct manifestation of Schrecklichkeit, and Schrecklichkeit is basically what has been used here in order to destabilize the Soviet economy by forcing them to attempt to match our military buildup. Continuing now with Sean Gervaisi's article. The next section is entitled "The Reagan Doctrine, a Full Court Press," quote-unquote. The fact that the Rand Corporation and other think tanks were in the early years of the last decade studying the possibilities of the strategy in question does not prove that the Reagan administration ever adopted such a strategy. However, in mid-1982, evidence began to emerge that the Reagan administration had actually adopted precisely the kind of policy which Rand had been studying and which Pipes had referred to. In May of 1982, a second White House official, a consultant to the National Security Council, met with a small group of reporters to give a background briefing. The subject was U.S. policy towards the Soviet Union. According to one reporter, the White House official outlined an extremely aggressive policy, and his remarks actually alarmed some of those present. Helen Thomas, the UPI White House correspondent, sent a dispatch about the meeting, which contained the following passage. Quote, "A senior White House official said Reagan approved an 8-page national security document that undertakes a campaign aimed at internal reform in the Soviet Union and the shrinking of the Soviet Empire. He affirmed that it could be called a full-court press, quote-unquote, against the Soviet Union. In basketball, a full-court press is a strategy of maximum pressure against one's adversary in every part of the court. It is an onslaught." A little more than a week later, documents relating to this strategy were being referred to and quoted in the press. On May 30th, Richard Halloran, H-A-L-L-O-R-A-N, of the New York Times, published a report on the Reagan administration's policy for fighting a nuclear war. He had obtained a copy of the fiscal year 1984 through 88 defense guidance, Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger's controversial document on, quote, prevailing, unquote, in a prolonged nuclear war. The Secretary's guidance document recommended a major escalation in the nuclear arms race. Quite apart from that, it indicated that many other measures were being taken to impose costs, quote unquote, on the Soviet Union. Halloran wrote, quote, "As a peacetime complement to military strategy, the guidance document asserts that the United States and its allies should, in effect, declare economic and technical war on the Soviet Union," unquote. Halloran also quoted the document directly as saying that the United States should develop weapons that, quote, "are difficult for the Soviets to counter, impose disproportionate costs, open up new areas of major military competition, and obsolesce previous Soviet investments," unquote. According to Halloran, the documents also stated that the Western trade policies should, quote, "put as much pressure as possible on a Soviet economy already burdened with military spending," unquote. I would interject, they've done a damn good job of doing that to our economy as well, to the great delight and ongoing well-being and profits of the Japanese and Germans. Continuing, thus, Halloran's article made it clear that many elements of a full-court press, quote-unquote, had been incorporated into the 1984-1988 defense guidance. William Clark, then Reagan's national security advisor, hinted at the existence of a full-court press at the time that... William Clark, then Reagan's national security advisor, hinted at the existence of a full-court press at the time that the defense guidance document was leaked to the New York Times. Speaking at Georgetown University on May 20th, 1982, he described emerging U.S. strategy as including, quote, "diplomatic, economic, and informational components built on a foundation of military strength," unquote. Clark was saying that Cold War rhetoric, policies towards East-West trade, public diplomacy, rearmament, etc., were all connected, all part of an overall plan. And he indicated that this strategy had a new purpose. Quote, "We must force our principal adversary, the Soviet Union, to bear the brunt of its economic shortcomings," unquote. By mid-1982, a number of studies, press reports, government documents, and official speeches had revealed the existence of a clear, coherent strategy towards the Soviet Union. This strategy went well beyond the traditional policies of containment. The Reagan administration was seeking not to oppose Soviet policies in the world, but to destabilize the Soviet Union itself. Despite Clark's remarks about the various components of U.S. strategy, it was still difficult to tell precisely what that strategy was. No one had identified its constituent elements except in the most general terms, so the outlines of the full-court press were only faintly visible. And the purpose of the strategy, internal reform, quote-unquote, in the Soviet Union, was not at all clear. The Reagan administration's new strategy did not actually come into clear focus until the spring of 1985. It was then that Gene Kirkpatrick provided a fuller description of the full-court press, interrupting, of course, Kirkpatrick was Reagan's ambassador to the United Nations. In a speech before members of the Heritage Foundation on May 10, 1985, Kirkpatrick described what she called the Reagan Doctrine, which was in fact a doctrine setting out the general lines of U.S. strategy towards the Soviet Union. "What I shall term Reagan Doctrine," Kirkpatrick said, "focuses on U.S. relations with the Soviet Union and its associated states." Kirkpatrick was careful not to reveal too much about the aim of the full-court press. She described the principal aims of the Reagan Doctrine as being, quote, "to redress the correlation of forces, stop Soviet expansion, clarify the nature of the contest," unquote. She did not mention internal reform, quote unquote, as an objective of U.S. policy, but did emphasize the need to pursue these objectives simultaneously. In the body of her speech, Kirkpatrick described the various components of the Reagan Doctrine in some detail, something which no one had done previously. And in so doing, she made it clear that they were all part of a coordinated plan, as William Clark had suggested 3 years earlier. According to Kirkpatrick, the Reagan Doctrine included the following important components. Rebuilding defenses, that is, expansion of U.S. military forces, developing new defenses, including the Strategic Defense Initiative, development and deployment of advanced weapons in the U.S. and Europe, withholding, quote, from our adversaries advanced technology of military importance, unquote, support for freedom fighters, unquote, that is, low-intensity war and proxy war. Propaganda, or what Kirkpatrick called a response at the ideological level to semantic infiltration and moral disarmament, unquote. A foreign assistance program that would utilize aid to expand and preserve freedom, unquote. And I would note a couple of things here. Development and deployment of advanced weapons in the U.S. and Europe. Developing new defenses, including the Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars. We're going to be coming back to that. Also, notice low-intensity war and proxy war. Once again, it should be noted, as I said in the first part of the broadcast, that in many ways the U.S. Military adventure in the Middle East was seen as a proxy war, and the effect of U.S. high-tech weapons was not lost on the Soviet military high command, and in turn is leading to pressure to not slash military defense, and military spending, I should say, because that is seen by elements of the Soviet general staff as placing them at a disadvantage vis-a-vis Western military and high-tech developments. That, again, is proxy war, and it should be seen here, in my opinion, as a continuation of the Reagan Doctrine expressed here by Jean Kirkpatrick. Interestingly enough, she was making this point in a speech to the Heritage Foundation. We will look at the Heritage Foundation, its connections to elements currently operating inside the Soviet Union, including elements connected to the milieu of Boris Yeltsin. Continuing here with Sean Gervaisi's article, Kirkpatrick left out of her account a number of components or policies which were clearly a part of the effort, quote, to redress the correlation of forces, unquote, and to stop Soviet expansion, unquote. These included such policies as the destabilization of Eastern Europe, the broad policy of economic as distinct from technical denial, and the continuation of arms control negotiations to moderate the Soviet response to the U.S. military buildup. Overall, Kirkpatrick's is the best single description of the Reagan Doctrine on the public record. It provides some insight into the general purpose of U.S. strategy while holding back from giving away too much. It should be clear that the Reagan Doctrine is the full court press, quote-unquote, which some reporters had briefly seen 3 years earlier behind the buzzing, blooming confusion of the shift to a harder line in foreign policy, quote-unquote. I would also note here, before we proceed, that arms control negotiations were seen here as a strategy to moderate the Soviet response to the U.S. military buildup. As I said earlier, I think in many ways, the, quote, end of the Cold War, unquote, and things like the intermediate range missile agreement in Europe could be seen as analogous to the way in which Adolf Hitler was able to peacefully acquire a lot of territory before he finally had to fire the first shots in Poland. And it should not be forgotten that the, quote, sellout at Munich, in which Neville Chamberlain was portrayed as being duped by Hitler, appears to have been something more than that. Neville Chamberlain was the political protege, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 1, of Sir Montague Norman, who was not only head of the Bank of England, but an enthusiastic supporter of Adolf Hitler, and an individual who actually funded Hitler directly from the Bank of England. It should also be noted that Neville Chamberlain himself was a key stockholder in Imperial Chemicals, which had a cartel agreement with IG Farben, the Nazi chemical firm, which was so intricate that during the Battle of Britain, the Royal Air Force actually had to pay royalties to IG Farben for the high-octane aviation fuel it was using to shoot down the Luftwaffe. So the sellout at Munich and Chamberlain's having been duped, quote-unquote, by Hitler appears to have been considerably more than that, in my opinion, and in that of many other people. What was basically happening was that Hitler was being deliberately walked up to the doorstep of the Soviet Union, and I think, at least in certain respects, the arms control negotiations and what have been portrayed in the press as steps towards peace, progress towards peace, to a certain extent at least, could be compared with Hitler's acquisition of first the Rhineland, then Austria, then the Sudetenland, and ultimately all of Czechoslovakia without firing a shot. And it remains to be seen exactly what happens in Eastern Europe, but we will be looking into events in Eastern Europe, and it appears that to term the demise of Soviet influence in that part of the world as the rise of democracy is at best premature and quite possibly the exact opposite of what is really going on. Continuing here with Sean Gervasi's article. The typical campaign of destabilization has involved two elements. The first is external pressure, the second is internal manipulation. The attacker is bent on creating disruption and turmoil in the target country, but that is only its first objective. The ultimate purpose is to produce a political change, typically a change of government, a coup d'etat, or even a revolution. There can be no assurance, however, that disruption and turmoil will produce the desired political results. Reading this paragraph again, because it's key. The typical campaign of destabilization has involved two elements. The first is external pressure. The second is internal manipulation. The attacker is bent on creating disruption and turmoil in the target country, but that is only its first objective. The ultimate purpose is to produce political change, typically a change of government, a coup d'etat, or even a revolution. There can be no assurance, however, that disruption and turmoil will produce the desired political results. Therefore, in most cases, the attacking power also intervenes in the internal political process in the target country. It does so in order to ensure that things move in the direction it wants. This intervention is usually covert, and it involves two steps. The first is the identification of, support for, strengthening, and even creation of political assets. These are influential individuals, civic groups, trade unions, youth groups, cultural organizations, and media organizations which are in conflict with or hostile to the government of the target country. These assets are then manipulated and used to further the political purposes of the attacker. This is what the United States and other Western countries have been doing inside the countries of the socialist bloc, and they have been intervening in the Soviet Union in an increasingly open fashion. In mid-1982, at the very moment that it was starting a full-court press against the Soviet Union, the Reagan administration was also preparing a large-scale intervention in the internal affairs of that country. At that time, the administration launched a remarkable initiative which was described as a quasi-governmental program aimed at promoting democracy in developing countries and, where possible, in communist nations, unquote. Democracy here belongs in quotes if ever anything did. The Reagan administration has never promoted democracy anywhere, least of all in the United States. Continuing here with Gervasi's account, according to U.S. officials, the project was intended, quote, to place political aid to developing countries on the same level as military and economic aid, unquote. Essentially, the promotion of democratic forces overseas was to be achieved through open financing of political parties, labor unions, and newspapers, and the provision of technical assistance. One more time. Essentially, quote, the promotion of democratic forces overseas, unquote, was to be achieved, quote, through open financing of political parties, labor unions, and newspapers, unquote, and the provision of technical assistance. Previously, operations of this nature had been the exclusive province of intelligence agencies. They were generally viewed when detected as interventionist and illegitimate. This new Project Democracy, quote-unquote, was no less interventionist, but it was well camouflaged. It proclaimed the indisputable desirability of democracy and so cloaked itself in virtue. A quasi-governmental institution, unquote, the National Endowment for Democracy, would later be created to administer the project. And the press dutifully reported that its launching, quote, would avoid the appearance that it is a United States government undertaking, unquote. Interrupting, of course, it was the National Endowment for Democracy, an inappropriately named organization if ever there was one, which through LCRA and LIC, as we looked at last week, is projecting fascist elements into Lithuania. Continuing here. The really controversial issue, of course, was whether the project would be used to promote democracy, quote-unquote, in communist countries. The Reagan administration was determined to use it for that purpose. In the spring of 1982, then Secretary of State Alexander Haig said, quote, just as the Soviet Union gives active support to Marxist-Leninist forces in the West and the South, we must give vigorous support to democratic forces wherever they are located, including countries which are now communist. We should not hesitate to promote our own values, knowing that the freedom and dignity of man are the ideals that motivate the quest for social justice. A free press, free trade unions, free political parties, freedom to travel, and freedom to create are the ingredients of the democratic revolution of the future, not the status quo of a failed past. There is no doubt that the phrases "a failed past," quote-unquote, and "the democratic revolution of the future," quote-unquote, were intended to refer to the present situation in the socialist countries and its hope for resolution. Subsequently, the Reagan administration harnessed many forces to promote democracy, quote-unquote, in the Soviet Union and other countries east of the Oder. These included the AFL-CIO, U.S. business, private sector organizations, some of which were intelligence agency fronts, the National Endowment for Democracy, political parties, and foundations in NATO countries, and the Republican and Democratic parties. By 1984, the program was well underway, especially in Poland and the Soviet Union. It was in 1984 that Richard Pipes reemerged to call attention to the possibilities in U.S. policy towards the Soviet Union. In an article in Foreign Affairs, Pipes explained how the growing crisis in the Soviet Union could and should be resolved. In Pipes' view, the Soviet Union was in a, quote, revolutionary situation, unquote, and he quoted Lenin on the subject. However, what was lacking at the time, he said, was, quote, the subjective element, the ability and will of social groups and social parties to transform the revolutionary situation, quote, unquote, quote, unquote, into a revolution. That last paragraph again. In Pipes' view, the Soviet Union was in a revolutionary situation, and he quoted Lenin on the subject. However, what was lacking at the time, he said, was the subjective element, the ability and will of social groups and social parties to transform the revolutionary situation into a revolution. Again quoting, but a way could be found around even this obstacle, as events in Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and Poland have shown. The only real way out of the crisis for the Soviet elite was by reform, and Pipes noted that in the past they had, quote, consented to make changes only under duress caused either by humiliations abroad or upheavals at home. That last sentence again. And Pipes noted that in the past they had, quote, consented to make changes only under duress caused either by humiliations abroad or upheavals at home. Unquote. Consider in this regard the program last week, the humiliation abroad, Iraq, and the upheaval at home, Lithuania, the, in essence, flanking maneuver, both on the northern and southern flanks of the Soviets, that I put forth last week. Continuing. At the time Pipes was writing, the full-court press, quote-unquote, had long been underway, and it had begun to produce greater economic difficulties in the Soviet Union, as well as humiliations abroad, quote-unquote. In Pipes' view, the Soviet elite had to be made to understand that reforms, quote-unquote, were, again quoting, the price it must pay for its survival, unquote. Pipes, of course, had a clear idea of exactly what the Reagan administration was doing and planning to do to threaten that survival. Again quoting, the key to peace, therefore, lies in an internal transformation of the Soviet system in the direction of legality, economic decentralization, greater scope for contractual and free enterprise, and national self-determination, unquote. In short, Pipes was calling for the dismantling of socialism in the Soviet Union. As he had indicated in 1981, the Soviet Union would either have to, quote, move in the direction of the West, unquote, or face the prospect of continuing humiliations abroad, quote, unquote, unsustainable costs, and greatly intensified pressure. Finally, years before the crisis in the socialist countries assumed its present dimensions, Pipes called for exactly the kind of intervention which was being set in motion under the banner of promoting democracy, quote, unquote. The West, he said, would be well advised to do all in its power to assist the indigenous forces making for change in the USSR and its client states. And that is just what the United States and other countries have been doing. It is not possible here to examine the many means which the West has used to manipulate the internal situation in socialist countries over the last 8 years. It is not possible here to examine the many means which the West has used to manipulate the internal situation in the socialist countries over the last 8 years, but they have been numerous. Obviously, throughout this period, intelligence agencies in the West have been highly active inside the socialist countries, although very little has been written or reported on the subject. So it is difficult to know what effect covert actions have had on the situation. What is striking today, however, is that so many public agencies and private organizations are doing exactly what intelligence agencies have done in the past. Government agencies, foundations, business groups, media organizations, human rights groups, trade unions, and others are all supporting and aiding opposition groups, particularly in the Soviet Union. They are openly aiding and guiding forces hostile to the socialist governments. They are, in short, actively working to produce that internal transformation, quote-unquote, of which Pipes spoke 6 years ago. One has only to read the documents of the National Endowment for Democracy, NED, the Department of State, and the U.S. Advisory Commission on Public Diplomacy to understand the scale of this intervention. What is equally striking is that this intervention is now openly talked about without the slightest criticism or protest from the Congress, the mass media, or opposition political groups in our own country. In January of 1990, at a meeting of the U.S. Advisory Commission on Public Diplomacy, Lawrence Eagleburger, the Deputy Secretary of State, called for an expanded role for U.S. agencies in assisting anti-communist groups in Eastern Europe. One of the things we need to do, and President Bush is clearly on that road with regard to Poland and Hungary, is to establish a mechanism within the government that helps provide the opportunity for the private sector to engage itself directly in the Polish experiment, the Hungarian experiment, or other experiments that are about to take place in Eastern Europe, unquote. Speaking at the same meeting, Carl Gershman, G-E-R-S-H-M-A-N, the president of the NED, told his audience that the endowment was already, quote, deeply engaged, unquote, in the election process in Czechoslovakia. And now, Mr. Gervasi's conclusion in the last section of this article. The fact that the Reagan administration set out to destabilize the Soviet Union in the early 1980s is startling in itself. The ambitiousness and scope of the full-court press have no historical precedent in modern U.S. foreign policy. That last sentence again. The ambitiousness and scope of the full-court press have no historical precedent in modern U.S. foreign policy. At the same time, it is difficult to know exactly how to assess the effects of these U.S. policies on the Soviet Union. Obviously, a number of factors have contributed to the present chaos in the Soviet Union and to the effort to reintroduce capitalism there. Thus, the internal situation of the Soviet Union might well have led to a deepening crisis over the years, even without U.S. pressure and manipulation. However, change might not have gone as far as it has, or gone so rapidly. And it might be that the new Soviet leadership would have chosen to remain within the bounds of socialism, something which it now appears to have rejected. Rubinstein may be overstating the case when he says that, quote, the key difference in Soviet policy is to be explained not by further deterioration of the Soviet economy, but in changes in U.S. foreign policy, unquote. But he may not be far off the mark. U.S. policies have undoubtedly helped to move things very far, very fast in the Soviet Union, particularly in recent years when aid to the anti-communist opposition has involved annual expenditures in the tens of millions of dollars. There needs to be further investigation of the facts before we can properly weigh the importance of U.S. policy in bringing about, quote, the end of the Cold War, unquote. As this article indicates, there is some question about whether the Cold War is indeed over. Once that issue has been settled, if it can be, a host of additional facts deserve consideration, not the least of which is the fact that the cost of the full-court press, quote, unquote, undoubtedly helped to create economic chaos in our own country. Well, again, that article, I think, speaks clearly for itself. It's well-written, and I think it is absolutely right on the money. We have been talking, with the exception of the discussion of NED in Lithuania, about the external pressure being applied to the Soviet Union. We are going to continue during the last part of tonight's archive show with discussion of the external pressure on the Soviet Union. We will begin next week, or we will resume, really, I should say, next week, with a discussion of the internal pressure on the Soviet Union as we take a look at the obvious interference in Soviet political affairs by our national security establishment using various fronts. And we will proceed with it from our discussion of the events currently going on in Lithuania, and we will talk about similar activities underway elsewhere in the Soviet Union. In weeks to come, we will talk about similar things going on in Eastern Europe as well. One of the most important aspects of this article is one of the most important sentences is the sentence where he observes that things can go wrong during destabilization operations. That's why you want to interfere in your opponent's political affairs. Things may very well go wrong, and who can say just what is going to go wrong, but interfering in the affairs of a nuclear superpower is a dangerous business.